98% pure potato.
98%
pure potato. The second section of chapter one, which is the context, is entitled, Dear Reader, What You Need to Know Before Venturing Further. This book is an exploration of the rise of account planning in London in the 1960s as seen through the eyes of those who did the job and the perspectives of a selective few who watched them do it. It is not a history book, nor is it a textbook, otherwise you might have lost interest already. Advertising is something almost everybody has an opinion about, something people will discuss animatedly with each other given the opportunity. Most people can tell you about an ad they like, usually a TV commercial, and they can tell you about advertising they dislike and complain that there is too much of the stuff. Very occasionally, advertising moves into the centre stream of culture, so commentators leap on it, programme makers parody it, and it becomes a regular topic of discussion in pubs and at parties. The 1960s was such a time. But today, mostly, advertising is tolerated and filtered out. What has changed since the 1960s is that marketing has become so widespread that you can hear people explain what the brand is doing and how they think the advertising works. But they will still tell you that they themselves aren't influenced by advertising, even if other people are. So, let us begin with a little ground clearing. Assuming that you are not an expert who spends all of your waking hours making advertising and thinking about it, or that you know nothing about it. To put you in the picture about how account planning came to start in London, of all places. The first point to make is that modern advertising is an American invention. Yes, we can find graffiti in Pompeii, and handbills are mentioned by Dr. Samuel Johnson, but it was the size and scale of America which turned advertising into a business which would help businesses reach their customers at distances of hundreds, if not thousands, of miles. It was the size of the USA which gave advertising its power. It was an American who got the idea of buying space in newspapers and selling it to businesses and offering to write the advertisements that filled it. Hooking the media on advertising is part of the revenue model ever since. It was another American who negotiated a flat rate media discount in return for buying the space, using the commission to remunerate himself. This system of payment became embedded for more than a century, only disappearing in the 1980s. While it was in place, the most successful advertising agents became wealthy because the flat discount goes a long way. The more media space is sold, the richer the agent becomes. The commission was negotiated for newspapers, magazines, outdoor advertising, and then commercial radio, and then commercial TV stations. An agent would have to satisfy the media owners that they were working on behalf of a group of clients. A client would be encouraged to give their advertising business to that agent on an ongoing basis, and the arrangement became known as an account. Agencies accumulated accounts by pitching for new business, by presenting campaign plans and advertising ideas. And they tried to grow the amount that each client spent because they benefited directly from the volume of spend. Advertising is a trade, not a profession. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Which is why all sorts of people have moved into advertising and a few have made fortunes out of it. You need no qualifications and there is no agreement about how advertising works. Except that it does. By the middle of the 20th century, you would find a handful of roles in an advertising agency. There was the rep who persuaded the client to buy the space. There were media buyers who picked the spaces and booked them. Both were courted assiduously by the media with lunches and all sorts of incentives. To persuade agencies to book space in their publications, they included media research which told you all about the lifestyles of those who read the publications and saw the advertising. Originally, the reps wrote their own ads, but soon the copywriting function began, where specialists wrote ads and were paid small fortunes because they could generate huge direct response ad and sales. Ads were word heavy, but this didn't stop them being effective. And then the visualizers arrived, who would add pictures to the advertising under the direction of copywriters. These designers worked in different offices and sometimes on different floors. The production line would lead with the client and end with the media owner. All of this originated in America, and because of the scale of the country, even though advertising agencies had a regional presence, inevitably hubs sprang up in the biggest conurbations, on the West Coast in San Francisco, in Chicago in the Midwest, and in New York on the East Coast. Agencies needed to coordinate the placing of advertisements in every publication. When cinema, radio, and TV were added on top of the press, they experimented with mass surveys to measure the impact of network advertising. Much as advertisers like to measure the effectiveness of advertising in sales, other factors influence sales, and advertising can do more than persuade people to purchase a product once. At one stage, TV audiences were measured on the calibrations of changing pressure in the water supply and spikes on the power grid as the audience flushed their toilets and put on kettles during commercial breaks. And in many countries, there were few limits on the minutes per broadcasting hour when commercial spots could be shown. And companies were able to sponsor the programs themselves. This is where the term soap opera comes from, as the detergent companies sponsored kitchen sink dramas, and have live presenters endorse products to camera close to program breaks. The soap companies became notorious for their volume of spending. At one stage, they even agreed to restrict their advertising spend so the new TV channels were not overwhelmed with exhortations to use product X or product Y. It should be obvious by now that advertising was conceived as selling, pure and simple. John E. Kennedy, at the beginning of the century, had defined press advertising as salesmanship in print. Four individuals are worth mentioning for the influence they wielded through the middle years of the 20th century in explaining how advertising worked. All four had their heyday in the 1950s, which meant their influence on advertising ideas was still flowing strongly in American advertising for the next decade. The first is Rosser Reeves of Ted Bates, who formulated the unique selling proposition. He claimed that advertising worked on immutable principles which needed to be applied ruthlessly. His theory, in a nutshell, was that there was a limited number of benefits from which a product could be advertised. One of the benefits was chosen because it was different from or superior to those of competitive products and was then hammered endlessly. It might be unpopular with the audience, but through sheer power of repetition, it would get noticed, get remembered, and would change people's purchasing preferences. Eventually, customers would believe whatever was said about the product benefits. It was the equivalent of carpet bombing. Reeves would use any medium, but his technique was most visible on the then new medium of television, where a limited set of brands fought it out with each other, making competitive claims, striving to carve out unique territory for themselves. Much of the language of today's advertising borrows heavily from Reeves' ideas, though he is rarely read today. The second was David Ogilvy, a British expatriate who moved to New York and started his own agency at the age of 35, which became eventually Ogilvy & Mather. Ogilvy's famous maxim was, "The consumer is not a moron, she is your wife." His approach was to use long copy to charm his audience and persuade them with the facts. Before Ogilvy worked in advertising, he spent some time working for George Gallup, so he used quantitative research and the techniques of direct response to calibrate the effects of his advertising. "My ideas about what constitutes good copy almost all derive from research, not personal opinion," he said. The form this subsequently took was rules of thumb about how many times the consumer was to be referenced in every 100 words of copy, how many words should be in the headline, why a question mark should never be used, and so on. He was also brother-in-law to Rosser Reeves, so the two of them claimed to agree with each other more than a cursory overview of their work might otherwise indicate. The third was Leo Burnett from Chicago, who also started his own agency. Burnett's approach was to dramatize the product. "We stress the inherent drama of things," he said, "because there is always something about that product that keeps it in the marketplace, something that makes that thing arresting and keeps people buying it." One of his campaigns for the Jolly Green Giant became so famous that the client, the Minnesota Canning Company, renamed itself after the advertising. Tony the Tiger for Kellogg's Frosties and the Marlboro Man were other examples of iconic campaigns which have lasted for decades. Burnett is important because his creation of advertising properties suggested that advertising could create long-term effects and that those effects were ultimately more valuable than driving short-term sales, even if he spoke more of campaigns than brands. The fourth was Bill Bernbach, the creative director of Doyle Den Bernbach in New York. He brought together copywriters and art directors and expected the interplay between the two to provide something new and unexpected. He held that advertising was not selling, but persuasion, and therefore not a science, but an art. Bernbach wanted to provoke and persuade the consumer. His understated work for the Volkswagen Beetle, Avis Rent-A-Car, and Levy's Bagels became legendary. It wasn't just what was said, it was how beautiful the ads looked, with acres of white space where the convention had been to fill every square inch with product claims and testimonials. He didn't like research because it blunted differences. One of the disadvantages of doing everything mathematically by research and by mandate, he said, is that after a while, everybody does it in the same way, because you go out and find the same things. If you think when you have found out what to say your job is done, then you're saying it the same way everybody else is saying it, and you lose your impact completely. The trick was to be different. Bernbach hired writers and art directors because they were individuals. He attempted no system. It was Bernbach's approach, idolized by writers and art directors alike, that triggered a creative revolution. DDB advertising was witty. It was popular with ordinary people, whether or not they were in the market for that product. Bernbach's approach suggested a different way for advertising to work, and his thinking has been compelling for creatives ever since. In the late 1950s, with the Cold War in full flow, Vance Packard published an incendiary book, Hidden Persuaders, in which he revealed the dangers of subliminal advertising and the motivational research which lay behind it. Motivational research comes from psychotherapy and explains consumer behavior in terms of drivers and associations, which are beyond the individual's understanding, but are all the more powerful because they are hidden. Only the analyst can spot them and draw them to the surface. Contrary to the direct approach of Reeves, Ogilvy, and Gallup, the hidden persuaders, for which read advertising agencies, made a single frame saying Coca-Cola flicker on a cinema screen, giving audiences a sudden inexplicable thirst. It didn't matter that the experiment referred to turned out to be a complete fabrication. America, in the throes of McCarthyism, and spooked by Russia taking the lead in the space race with Sputnik, swallowed a magical theory of advertising that made you do things you didn't even know you were doing. It made advertising sound sexy and dangerous at the same time. Motivational research made small fortunes for consultants like Ernst Dichter, who had moved from Vienna to New York to ply his trade as a psychotherapist working for business, but agencies became wary of being seen to undermine consumer choice. The real issue was the volume of advertising that people were being exposed to. There were few advertising channels, but they were crammed with advertising, and it wasn't popular. The consumerization of America did not go unchallenged. Ralph Nader spent the 1960s challenging the US automotive industry on the safety of its cars and arguing that manufacturers like General Motors were not behaving in their customers' interests. Consumerism cut both ways, a way to self-define using products and services, but also a way to kick back at brand owners who did what they wanted and kept an army of lawyers in case of a very public product failure. The creative revolution was all the more powerful because of the way advertising, with its repeated claims or its attempt to get underneath the radar into the subconscious, had forfeited public goodwill. Creative advertising might get the advertising talked about and it might be liked. The drawback with creative advertising was that just because it was witty or humorous, it was no guarantee of effectiveness. On the West Coast, the ad man Howard Gossage railed against the billion-dollar hammer on the 30-cent tack and argued that advertising broke the First Amendment, tipping the balance of power too far towards advertisers and away from the public. He argued that almost all advertising was trivial and banal. The only advertising that could be morally justified needed to be utterly interesting and diverting. Gossage's methods were unorthodox, to say the least. His Pink Air campaign for finer gas stations is an apt illustration. Each press advertisement was placed once only. Gossage argued that the succession of ads was a conversation with the audience, so he shouldn't need to repeat himself. He took marginal features and made them central. Pink air being put into car tyres at finer gas stations. Give away pink balloons inside another transparent balloon so that you can see what pink air looks like. A competition to win 15 yards of pink asphalt. Why pink air? No reason, but it makes what would otherwise be an identical suite of gas station services seem more interesting. But it isn't just the off-the-wall nature of his creative ideas. In Gossage's book, Is There Any Hope for Advertising?, he proposed using the New York Times as the best place to launch a campaign, with advertising men as the primary audience, because they talk to clients for nothing, with the client's own competitors as the secondary audience, and with the consumers as a distant third. When advertisers speak of consumers, he said, they think they mean people, but they don't. A consumer is a functional being designed to use whatever it is you have to sell. He will therefore be a grotesque on the order of Hieronymus Bosch, all mouth or belly. Consumers are non-existent, except in the manufacturer's imagination. Gossage saw advertising campaigns as interventions that create cultural change, which is why he didn't need to worry about too much about selling products to real people. He wanted to be interesting and engaging and claimed that he could deliver commercial results by being the outstanding brand communicator in a given category. There was no point in reaching everyone and speaking to them multiple times. You will only succeed in boring them. Another of his metrics was not using up the client's advertising budget or getting paid for telling the advertiser not to advertise at all. That's what he told Volkswagen. Dorden Bernbach gave different advice and produced one of the greatest advertising campaigns of all time. According to Gossage, advertising VW Beetles was unnecessary. The product was quite distinctive enough. We mention Gossage because the ideas of the intellectual creative impresario were influential, even if his methods weren't followed. The concept of the creative genius, beloved of artists and designers, moved effortlessly into the advertising, where great copywriters had long been lionized for writing advertisements that created huge response. These iconoclasts didn't actually have to meet real people, any more than best-selling novelists do, to demonstrate that their writing reflected the attitudes and aspirations of real people. Research, particularly quantitative research, was dismissed as vague and self-serving of the organisation, usually a media company paying for it. Gossage has strong views that the medium chosen needed to be integral to the advertising idea. He introduced Marshall McLuhan to the United States, organising a lecture tour for the Canadian academic. He used the ideas of Norbert Wiener, the father of cybernetics and systems thinking, to define communications effectiveness by consumer response, which is why he put multiple coupons in his ads to test the water. Gossage gathered a coterie of other intellectuals, including Buckminster Fuller and the writers Tom Wolfe and John Steinbeck. This fad for creativity out of the box and off the wall spread across the advertising industry through the 1960s, wherever there were clients who were fighting overwhelming odds, being outspent by corporations with the firepower to pound audiences into submission. It was a significant movement in the UK too, as we shall see. By the end of the 1950s, US corporations were expanding around the world and taking advertising ideas with them. And for the most part, clients in other parts of the world and their agencies knuckled down and adopted the practices and theories which had come out of America in the first place. The one contrary exception was the account planning movement, which started in the UK. In the next section, we will look at how these advertising ideas played in the UK and how they came to incite a revolt called account planning. The creative revolution may have started in the USA, in line with all the other innovations you might expect from a business superpower, but account planning is the only advertising innovation that began not in the USA, but in London.